Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we're discussing the upheaval within the Oakland Police Department. An ever-widening sex scandal has thrown the Oakland PD into chaos over the last several weeks, as reports emerged that at least 14 Oakland police officers sexually exploited a teenage girl, and in some cases revealed confidential information about undercover sting operations. In a separate scandal, a number of OPD officers have been accused of sending racist texts and are currently under investigation. The department lost three police chiefs in the span of 9 days last month and now remains under the control of the city administrator, Sabrina Landreth. And these are only the latest crises for the department. It has been under a federal consent decree for more than a decade, following a scandal known as the Writers' Case, in which a group of officers beat and terrorized African-American and Latino residents. Tonight, we'll look at the current crisis and explore its structural causes. What about department culture must change? What reforms have succeeded? And how can the department secure the trust of the communities it polices? Joining me in the studio this evening to discuss these issues and more are Jack Glazer. He's professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, where he focuses on stereotyping, prejudice, and discrimination. He also works with UCLA's Center for Policing Equity, investigating police stops and use of force incidents. His latest book is Suspect Race, Causes and Consequences of Racial Profiling. Welcome, Professor Glazer.
Thank you.
We're also joined here in the studio by Dan Lindheim. He is former city administrator for the City of Oakland from 2009 to 2011. Previously, he headed Oakland's Community and Economic Development Agency and was senior advisor to Congressman Ron Dellums. He is also a lecturer at the Goldman School of Public Policy. Welcome, Dan Lindheim.
Good to be here.
And finally, by phone, we're joined by John Burris. He's lead attorney with the Oakland-based John L. Burris Law Offices, where he focuses on civil rights litigation. He has represented plaintiffs in numerous police misconduct cases, including the 2003 Oakland Writers case. He is currently representing the family of Mario Woods, who was shot and killed by San Francisco police officers in December 2015. Welcome, John Burris.
Good. Good to be with you, as always. Good to hear from you, Dan. Haven't seen you in a while.
Good to talk to you, John.
Mm-hmm.
And for the record, we did invite the Oakland Police Department to join us for this conversation this evening, but the department declined. And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and that number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at City Visions KALW. So I wanted to start with the same question to all three of you. I'm going to quote here from the 2016 strategic plan that former Oakland Police Department Chief Sean Wendt published at the end of 2015, stating that the values of the Oakland Police Department are fairness, integrity, respect, service, and teamwork. So I wanted each of you in turn to comment on how you see the Oakland Police Department meeting or not meeting those values as of the present day. And I wanted to start with you, John Burris.
Well, I will say that the various events that have taken place more recently certainly have undermined the police department's effort at trying to maintain these various principles that Chief Wendt articulated. Because when you have this kind of activity regarding the sex scandals, the tech scandals, losing police chiefs, and of course the underwriting of all that with the Writers' case, it's very difficult for the officers to really promote and engage in the concepts that are the mottos of the department. It's a real challenge because ultimately you need the respect of the community to carry out these various tasks and do the kind of policing that is absolutely necessary to have the respect of the citizens. But when you have a sex scandal, and I'll say this because, and Dan would know this, we spent a lot of our time on the Writers' case dealing with the police and its interaction with the community. And much effort has been made around the racial profiling questions and other issues about the use of force, but we did not foresee nor did we give due consideration to the fact that officers themselves would be engaged in illegal conduct of involving sexual activity that would undermine totally the integrity of what we were trying to get done or what they were trying to get done. Then you topple all that with the sex texting, racial texting by officers that, to me, sends a poor message. It undercuts a lot of what was trying to you do in trying to put forth a professional environment that is race neutral in its manner, but yet you have officers sending amongst themselves, even amongst black officers, these kind of texts. Seems to me undermines the very framework that we're trying to get done, and obviously losing police chiefs the way they have been done. And I say this, that Chief Wendt, we thought, really understood what we were trying to get, what he wanted to get done on the modern-day policing of a department, and tried to implement some of the various values that he talked about. Unfortunately, there was a cancer within the department that he ultimately got caught up in that ultimately led to his demise. So it's a challenge for departments to maintain the kind of integrity that they need. The culture in that department can sometimes undermine the principles that you have in mind, and those principles can be undermined by not only the culture that you have, but how the officers carry out their duties. Because ultimately, you need the respect of the community if you want to carry out and be an effective police agency.
So, a couple of follow-up questions before I go to the other two guests on that question. So, you've been involved in the oversight, so to speak, of the Oakland Police Department through the litigation that you've brought to bear for quite some time. Where do you see the department today compared when you first started working on these issues?
Well, I will say in many areas it has vastly improved. I mean, one of the issues we were concerned about, obviously, is the use of force. Those numbers have gone down considerably. You know, the investigation of those matters have been good, and we've had a whole lot of issues in dealing with the consistency of discipline by officers. That real efforts have been made around it, the supervision of officers. These are internal matters that I think on whole have been good as it relates to the function of the department. And certainly the one unfinished business has been on the issue of racial profiling, but even there we were making real good progress. We hired a person from Stanford to looking at the stop data cards, and so and just before the chief was let go, we were having meetings on how to come to grips with some of these areas, whether it was acknowledging that African Americans were being stopped at a disproportionate rate, acknowledging that handcuffing was something that was done surprisingly in terms of our data on unconscionable rates, and then certainly coming to grips with the whole question of African Americans being stopped and searched. These were areas that we were in the process of getting a handle on that are progress or a function of the writers' agreement that we've been involved in. But as I said, this certainly has been hijacked in many ways by the more recent events.
And the second follow-up is, you mentioned that you could never have predicted that the staff police officers would be conducting themselves in the way that they have been alleged to conduct themselves. And at the same time, you're also saying that you feel like Chief Wendt kind of was caught up in something that perhaps he couldn't overcome. So who's ultimately responsible here for what happens?
The chief is totally responsible because the way the thing has been reported in the newspaper is clear that there were steps along the way that the different decisions should have been made. It was only after the court issued an order back in March where they indicated that there were some concerns about the internal investigations that were taking place related to this sexual misconduct that was the time when the chief himself should have been aware and should have taken corrective action sooner. So in my view, this obviously is the chief's responsibility and fault as it relates to the sexual thing, but at the same time, the culture that allowed for that to take place, I don't put that at the foot of the chief per se. This was a certain culture that existed within a department that they themselves, the officers themselves, were protective of each other. And it was there, it was more a culture of misconduct. Boys will be boys, if you will, and they were protected and each other and other people outside of the department. I can't say that's the chief's fault. That's the culture of officers getting along with each other and doing what they're doing that extends beyond the chief itself. However, it seems to me that the issues of accountability, the issues of integrity from the individual officers, that obviously wasn't there, and that may very well have been a function of the hiring and training practices that took place regarding these various officers and the overall concept of whether the department is hiring people of high integrity at much earlier stages. And so that's another issue that we have been looking at, and that is the hiring and training practices.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was John Burris. He's an Oakland-based civil rights attorney opening our hour here as we talk about the Oakland Police Department. I wanted to now pose that same question to Dan Lindheim, former city administrator for the city of Oakland. John mentioned that you and he have worked together on this issue for a number of years. So tell us, what's your assessment of the current state of the Oakland Police Department when it comes to values like fairness, integrity, respect, service, teamwork, especially in light of the scandals that have come to bear in the last few months?
So just in spirit of disclosure, I'm almost 5 years gone. So what I know is what I've talked to people. I do talk to people in OPD all the time, but I'm not a manager anymore, so I don't really know. So that's the first thing. Clearly, during the time that I was there, there were enormous changes that took place. And when you talk to people who were there earlier and they compare it to even a couple of years ago, they would all say that there are just enormous changes have taken place. Now, there's been enormous turnover in the department. So one of the things that happened was there were massive layoffs of officers. There were 80 officers who were terminated in 2010, at late 2010. And the number of officers in the police force was quite low for a number of years. They're starting to bring that back, but there are a substantial number of new officers. And based on what I've read in the newspaper and my knowledge of the current scandal is newspaper knowledge, a lot of the officers who were caught up in it are relatively young, yet relatively new officers. So it's hard to know to what extent there's been a lack of continuity, to what extent there was a lot of change that was taking place, and then all of a sudden there's a new generation and they're not being appropriately supervised. It's really hard to know from a distance. One of the things that's I just want to point out, and it's not directly responsive, but let me just point it out. The NSA, there's nothing in the negotiated settlement agreement that says cops should not engage in illegal activity. I mean, that's – and as John sort of indicated that, I mean, you sort of presume the cops are not going to engage in sexually exploitive behavior. You know, they're not going to engage in sexual trafficking or deal in prostitution or deal in protection rackets or anything else. You would presume that that's – they're not going to do that. What the chief got caught up in, from my understanding, and why the court got involved was there wasn't an adequate investigation. And apparently either he blew it off or didn't take it sufficiently seriously or didn't move in more aggressively in terms of discipline. And one of the core aspects of the NSA was not just the substantive things like thou shalt not engage in racial anything, that there shouldn't be bias, there shouldn't be discrimination, there shouldn't be criminal activity. It was more procedural kind of things in the sense of how do you go about investigating? How do you make sure that there are investigations? How do you make sure that they're done in an aggressive and appropriate way? And I think that, to me, the failing here and what it shows, and I don't want to minimize in any sense the substance of the scandal, but from a departmental point of view, what it shows is that there hasn't still been enough effort to make sure that everything is taken absolutely seriously and that nothing gets a pass. And I think that somehow either the chief didn't know sufficient information or didn't take it sufficiently seriously. That I just don't know the facts of it. But what's really missing from a departmental management point of view is the fact that the investigation wasn't taken seriously enough. Now, I don't want to give a pass in any way to the absolute illegal activity of these officers. I mean, if they did what they supposedly did, and everybody seems to say they did, I mean, that's just completely unacceptable. But that, I think, is a different issue. And, you know, it's unacceptable, and it's a management issue because you really have to tell people what you want them to do. I mean, if there was any one thing I learned, particularly in managing demonstrations, and we were relatively successful in managing the Oscar Grant demonstrations and got relatively good press, was that if you don't want officers or you don't want the police department to act in a sort of stereotypical way, you have to order them not to do that. And so in some of these cases, you know, you just have to order people. You have to explain to people, look, as cops, you are not entitled to any privileges. You are not entitled to engage in illegal activity. You are not entitled to do any of these things. You know, why anybody would presume that they could, I can't answer that question.
So are you saying that that there was a path that this department was going on that was positive, and now somehow this other issue just comes out of left field? Or do you feel like it's growing out of the issues that have plagued the department for as long as they have?
I think there's been a lot of transition. And so there was an enormous amount of transition in the city administrator position. Sabrina Landreth, who's the current city administrator, there were six different people between me and her. Five of them were interim. And what that really meant is nobody was really watching the store. And from the point of view of a police department, when Howard Jordan left, and then there were a number of chiefs for a day, and then Sean Wendt was put in, Sean was not the obvious person to take over, and he spent a lot of time trying to exercise his leadership, and he grew in the job, and I think he seemed to have been doing a really good job. But there just wasn't a whole lot of management of everything, and it's very hard to hold one person responsible for the activities of 800 people. And in the case of the police department, I mean, there's something now, they're close to 800 officers there, and another 200 or so civilians. But, you know, as city administrator, where I was responsible for 5,000 employees, you know, I mean, to what extent could I really hold myself responsible, or should other people hold me responsible for what, you know, one or two or even 16 employees did? My responsibility was to make sure that never happened again, and to make sure that people were appropriately disciplined and terminated if appropriate. And we terminated a number of officers for very bad activity.
So what do you think the responsibility of the current administration of Oakland, the city of Oakland, is regarding this scandal? Because you're saying that, you know, it's really only so much that any city administrator could do, and especially with all the turnover. But do you see that at some point the accountability has to go and knock on the mayor's door?
I mean, technically the mayor has no legal authority to supervise anybody. The city administrator has plenary authority in that sense. The mayor has all the political authority, but the administrative authority vests in the city administrator. So whether the mayor should be held responsible, I think the mayor has to give signals. I think the mayor has to affect the environment and say, look, this is unacceptable. You know, and she made the comment, well, she's not running a frat house. I think it has to be more serious than that. And I think it has to be made very clear by all levels of management within the department and within the city that illegal activity can't be tolerated, and that privileged activity, whatever that is, also can't be tolerated, and extend it to issues of bias and everything else that we've been trying to change in the department. But I just think you have to make it very, very clear that inappropriate activity and illegal activity and biased activity just cannot be tolerated.
I'm going to turn to you next, Professor Glaser, but I want to reintroduce the program and see if we can get some of our listeners to join our conversation. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the Oakland Police Department with our guest, Jack Glaser, who we'll hear from in a moment, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, Dan Lindheim, former city administrator for the city of Oakland, and John Burris, Oakland-based civil rights attorney. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Professor Glaser, I wanted to turn to you next. Same question. Fairness, integrity, respect, service, teamwork. Where do you see the department currently? And if you could build on the comments of our previous two guests, where, how does this this current scandal fit in the arc of scandals of the Oakland Police Department in the last decade or so?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing I'd say about those standards that Chief Wendt laid out are that they're all laudable, but they're pretty generic. And I think that, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a police department that wouldn't stand behind those or be comfortable putting those forward, or really a lot of different types of organizations across industries. So I don't know how much we can say about those, except to say that probably the overwhelming majority of officers within the Oakland Police Department were trying to uphold those standards. Now, I'm not going to pretend to understand the scandal. And on the occasions when I could steel my stomach enough to read the news on it, I still couldn't, you know, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't really get a handle on what happened. And I don't have any information about what happened inside of OPD in terms of how it was managed. I will say that it's more than just officers engaged in illegal activity. It's a particular kind of illegal activity that shows an insensitivity to their power and their ability to exploit that. And we were talking about a young woman who, again, I haven't been able to figure out who this person is particularly, but she was 17 when this all started, and that reflects, you know, poor character on the part of the officers involved. As to whether or not that was something that was known to the leadership of the department or when it became known to whom, I really can't comment. But it is something that legitimately undermines confidence of the community and other people watching OPD. And that is important because the other side of this is, as John and Dan have indicated, OPD really was making strides, particularly on the areas that the monitor was focused on, which is reducing bias, reducing excessive force. And not only were they making progress, but they were starting to be looked at as a national leader. And so it's particularly tragic that you see that all unravel because of some behavior that is not related to, or at least not directly related to, what the efforts were, the central efforts of reform that were occurring. And, you know, Sean Wendt is a very bright, very progressive, very competent chief. I don't know what he did or failed to do in regard to this particular scandal, but his departure is a real loss for Oakland.
So it's 14 officers that are alleged to have mm-hmm. engaged in this behavior, not a small number in a force of mm-hmm. 800. I'm not asking you to actually know the answer to this question, but how do you make sense, if the department was on this positive trajectory for so long, how could this coexist in the same department? Do you have a sense in your understanding of sort of the culture of policing, of police departments, of how you could have both things happen at the same time?
Yeah, I'm not that blown away that both things were happening at the same time, that there was a strong push at the top level for a more fair and equitable policing, and that you could have this kind of misconduct, to put it mildly, happening amongst a small number of the ranks. And only because these are moral failings that I think people have a hard time reconciling or seeing as operating on the same dimension.
Well, it's actually breaking the law, right?
It's breaking the law, but it's sort of a personal well, and, you know, we make a distinction between moral and legal transgressions. And so I'm not going to argue that this is one or the other. This is clearly illegal, and I think it's immoral. But I think it's possible that officers could compartmentalize their own personal salacious behavior from the clear goals that were being expressed by the department to treat people of color with dignity and fairness. These are human beings. I mean, that's really something we have to bear in mind all along, that police officers are human beings. They're normal human beings for the most part. They probably differ on some personality characteristics. There's something about them that causes them to self-select into a particular kind of industry that's very unusual. But on the other hand, they're also subjected to psychological testing before they're admitted to the academy. And so, you know, you could argue that they're more psychologically normal than the average member of the population. So I don't think we're talking about anything particularly unusual here in Oakland, and I wouldn't lay this at the feet of the unique culture of Oakland PD, but I would say that this is not something that you should be entirely surprised happens within a police department, given the nature of that population. And of course, there's also some idiosyncratic thing going on here with this, the particular circumstances of this case.
John Burris, I wanted to get you back in here. Yeah, go ahead.
And that is the good majority of the officers involved here from Oakland Police Department, but there were officers involved in other police agencies with this young woman. So I think it goes more to Professor's comment about individuals misbehaving or taking advantage of a situation, because this went to Richmond PD, Contra Costa Sheriff Department, Alameda County Sheriff Department, San Francisco, it's been alleged, is involved. So, and these are all individual guys. And so it's guys who took advantage of an opportunity for whatever reason. The part that's most disturbing as it relates to Oakland, though, is that, from my point of view, is that it was not discovered until somebody committed suicide. And he left a note, which means all of these guys, all of them were participating in this conduct at various levels, and we don't know when, but none of them came forward. None of them had enough moral integrity to say that this is just wrong. They all kept quiet. And that's part of the culture that I've always been worried about, and I think that we've been trying to deal with, is that if you're aware of misconduct, you have a duty to come forward. And here is these officers, not only they were aware of the misconduct by other officers, and they were aware of the misconduct they were engaged in, but not one of them came forward and indicated. So that, to me, is the real cultural problem, the code of silence. That's even worse than just the code of silence that might exist when you beat somebody up. But this is where people are engaging in illegal conduct. That, to me, is the most and immoral conduct, because not only and violation of policy. I mean, that within the department. So that those are the issues that are most disturbing to me about this conduct, is that all these people kept quiet, and they all knew that others were engaged in this conduct, and none of them came forward.
So I want to ask you to respond to something that Dan Lindheim said a little while ago, which is that a lot of this maybe had to do with the fact that there was a lot of turnover in the department, and these are younger, newer recruits to the department, and so they're younger people. And of course, at that time, there was also lots of changes, turnover in the city administrator's office. When you say culture, that portends something that's much more longstanding. So, what's your take on this issue of, is this part of a culture of the Oakland Police Department? Is this about a unique point in time when factors kind of conspired to create a setting like this? What's your take on that?
I had other cases earlier, maybe before Dan got there, involving sexual misconduct on the part of officers. So that, to me, is not a unique situation. It's just that it was so widespread and it was involving one particular person. Now, in terms of the youthfulness, now, when I've been told that it didn't all that this extended beyond the youthfulness of several of officers who were very young. It included some officers who were supervisors, some officers who were well down the track in terms of their experience. So it may be that there were young officers who were involved in the initial events. Certainly the officer who committed suicide was very young, and some of these other officers are also 2 or 3 years out of training. But I will say this, the culture of silence, it's something that is transmitted down from one generation to the next generation of officers. So that the fact that you're only there a short period of time, you can get that real quickly. And officers have gotten that as officers, do not snitch on officers. In fact, I've represented officers who have been beaten up by other officers, and the officer who was beaten up is the one that was ostracized by the other officers. So the culture of silence is not something that only comes up very quickly. It is something I think that's ingrained in many ways within the structure of and the culture of this department and other departments as well. This is not a unique phenomena to policing per se.
Okay. I want to get both Dan Lindheim and Jack Glaser to respond. First, you, Dan Lindheim.
Well, I mean, I agree with John's comments. I want to – one of the things that always bedeviled me about trying to implement the negotiated settlement is there was no question that we had won the hearts and minds of the leadership, the chief and the deputy chiefs and the assistant chiefs and the captains. The real issue to me was, how do you reach the rank and file? And the only way you reach the rank and file is by reaching the sergeants. And in a large organization, especially in a military-style organization, trying to bring that about, I just don't know how you – the only way you really bring about that kind of change is to convince the people who are really the managers on the front line. And I don't know what happened here. I mean, I'm really – you know, it's incredibly upsetting. It's – you know, it clearly is a setback regardless of whether or not this was individual behavior or concerted behavior. It's clearly a setback in terms of the perception of the department. And but, you know, even though we made enormous changes at the higher levels and in bringing about policy and bringing about and ordering things, it was always a question to me, you know, what's really going on at the lowest levels, which is where all the officers are. And I mean, when I say lowest, I mean just, you know, from a status point of view. And
well, how do you get what is written on paper to actually become what becomes the practice on the streets?
Well, that's what's so difficult. And one of the problems of the NSA is that a lot of it was substantive, but a lot of it was sort of bureaucratic stuff, filling out forms, filling out. And so there was a lot of pushback from rank and file saying, look, do you want me to be a cop or do you want me to fill out forms? And so that was – so there wasn't – you know, even the time that when I was there, there wasn't, let's just say, 100% buy-in on about everything about the NSA. But people understood that it was something that had to happen and they were being ordered to do that, and okay. But the real issue in trying to bring about – change within an organization is you can't just declare it. You have to work on it and work on it. And so that's what's partly so upsetting to me about this is clearly it's not done.
Right. So you can't sort of legislate it to happen. You can't demand it to happen. The multiple settlements that the city of Oakland has paid over the last decade don't necessarily translate at the end of the day.
Even though enormous amount of changes have taken place. Right. I mean, it's not the same department.
Okay. So Jack Glazer, go ahead.
Yeah. So I just want to expand on this notion. You can change rules and you can put that in a department's duty manual and you can convey it with general orders and the various kinds of policy documents, but you can't put a culture into a policy document. A culture is an organic thing and it has to grow and develop. And so that is going to be a challenge. I think Oakland was trying to change their culture. I think their primary emphasis was on their culture with regard to police contact with civilians during enforcement activities. And so this kind of thing maybe didn't get across. These kinds of expectations for this type of behavior, off-duty behavior, didn't come across. But that's a problem. And the other thing we need to bear in mind is that getting back to this notion that a good number of these perpetrators were young is that young men behave badly. And that's just a psychological reality. And some of these guys are entering – well, and this is actually an important trend across policing, that police are starting older. Departments are expecting – older, and they are more prone to recruit people out of college. And you would be surprised at how many police officers these days have master's degrees. So that's a positive trend that I think will help with this. But if you're recruiting 18-year-olds whose frontal lobes really, frankly, haven't fully developed yet, then you're going to see this kind of behavior. And I think that gets to Dan's point that they need to be told how to behave across a lot of different domains. And you shouldn't expect that they're just going to do the right thing.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the Oakland Police Department with our guests, Jack Glazer, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, Dan Lindheim, former city administrator for the City of Oakland, and on the phone, John Burris, Oakland-based civil rights attorney. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. John Burris, did you want to say something there?
Yeah, I think that I want to follow up on both things that have been said, because I do think it's important. First off, I think the mistake that Jim Channon and I made, and at the court and everybody was involved, is we did not include the police officers, the working police officers, in our discussion on what should be done and how to improve this. And as a consequence, there wasn't the buy-in. And it took years for that buy-in to occur, and I think that largely it was resistance, because these two guys who were not police officers were trying to tell them how to do it. And even though there was some buy-in by command, there was not buy-in by the lieutenants and the sergeants. And those were the people who really had to do the work, and that's because we didn't include the union as part of it. The union was what I think a vital part in terms of the necessity of getting things done. And so I don't think that we really did that in ways that it should have been done. And in retrospect, I believe that we should have had more parties to the table who had practical experience in what this means for policing, as opposed to my notion or Jim's notion about best practices that we had read in a book somewhere, as opposed to talking to the police officers and having them involved in it. Even though we had some people involved, I don't think we got enough real hard-nosed policing people involved who understood what the day-in, day-out form of policing and the impact that it would have on them. And that, I think, contributed largely to the length. But I will say this finally. We were close to the end. We really only had two or three matters left and to get into compliance. But at the same time, obviously, we were torpedoed by this scandal that took place that we really didn't have our eye on at the beginning.
So Dan Lindheim, I want you to respond to that about this process, about obviously the negotiated settlement agreement happened before your term. But what's your take on this notion that it, because it didn't involve the rank and file, it was in some ways doomed to fail?
I don't think it was necessarily doomed to fail. I mean, we made a major effort to include the union. So the union was only an intervener technically in the formal proceedings, but we actively involved the union, brought them into command staff meetings, brought them into all of our implementation meetings. But then again, you still have an issue that the union leadership are still only two guys, and as decent and as good as they may be, you know, they don't have direct command authority over the rest of the rank and file. And even when you have a larger steering committee of the union, that's still only a few guys. And so the issue is ultimately in bringing about change, how do you really involve all of the rank and file? And I think the magic is you really have to aggressively involve the sergeants. And, you know, I just don't think that was sufficiently done. And I don't think it was because somebody didn't think of it necessarily. I think it's just, you know, it's a lot of people to involve in a lot of things. And, you know, you just don't have that many times that senior people get to meet with the rank and file, and you go to lineups, and we went to innumerable lineups and talked about issues and things, but it's still not the same thing. And so ultimately, there has to be an absolute commitment from the department, and the rank and file have to really respect the leadership of the department. And I think at various times that wasn't completely the case.
Let's go to some of our listeners. Again, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. If you want to join our conversation with our guests tonight about the Oakland PD, the number to dial is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Let's go first to Harry from San Francisco. Harry, welcome to the program. I don't think we actually have Harry. I think Harry's on line one. There you are, Harry.
Managerial process.
Harry, could you go ahead and start over? We had the wrong phone caller queued up there. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, compliments to all of you for a great, thoughtful discussion. From which I've inferred a seriously defective managerial process. Connected to that, I'm interested in understanding a little bit more about the accountability chain of command beyond the chief of police. And it's not clear to me as to what other levels of supervision required for not only for the management of it, but also to understand accountability.
Thanks so much, Harry, for your call. So you know, a civilian oversight. Right. Let's say it's not the city administrator or the mayor only, but civilian oversight. Jack, do you want to say something there?
Yeah, this is a really big issue in policing these days. And part of it is that there's a lack of satisfaction with the effect of civilian oversight. So, a number of cities, Oakland included, have a community police board, and they will review complaints, but they rarely have their own authority to do anything about that. They'll refer the complaints back to the police department to see if there's any accountability there, and then it'll actually typically get run through the Internal Affairs Department as well. So there has been concern. There's been specific motion in Oakland to develop a more robust civilian oversight of the police. And there are some cities that have had some success with that. But one of the general trends is that when civilian oversight boards review complaints and refer them back to police departments, they almost never get sustained. It's a very rare case that the police department will actually consider to have been founded and sustained as a complaint. So that's a tough issue. You also have, you know, civilians like the mayor and the city administrator overseeing the department, but they're not in there, except for right now in Oakland, apparently. They're rarely right in there supervising directly. And I think Dan was probably maybe a little more involved than some. So in terms of how to have that accountability higher up the chain or beyond the chain of command, there aren't a whole lot of compelling models, but there's a considerable demand for it.
A listener tweets, the guests are saying 14 is a small number and not reflective of the department. The listener calls that, quote unquote, BS. Let's go to another caller here, Nancy from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Hey, I have a question and then a comment. It wasn't clear to me in the case with the 17-year-old who was being trafficked by the police officers, whether anyone was being charged or if anyone just, you know, like lost their jobs, or I'm just curious what the status of the gentleman involved is. If there's anything
some
like that.
Some officers have resigned in Oakland, and some officers in other departments have been reassigned from their position, particularly those in the Richmond Police Department. They've been reassigned. But I'll tell you, from my point of view, that I really think that that there should be an outside agency, namely the Attorney General, or some agency that can overlook at all these cases, take control of them, and to see who should be prosecuted and who shouldn't be prosecuted. And the issue that I have here is not just the girl was just 17 or 18. This is a human trafficking type problem. These guys, some of them were not only providing, getting sex from this girl, but they were also providing allegedly information to her so that she knew not to work a particular corner at a particular time. Other guys were coming off their jobs in the middle of the day, having sex with her. I mean, this was round robin, passing this girl around, and they became her like pimp.
And they
should be prosecuted and/or certainly should be terminated from policing. You don't need to tell a
officer
that you shouldn't be having sex with a girl on your job.
It's illegal. And my point is that officers, this is illegal behavior. They should be held to, because of the control and the power they have over the, you know, the community, they should be held to a higher standard, not like a zero standard. Like, they can break the law, and not only are they not even losing their jobs, and they're not even being prosecuted. Do you know what I mean?
They should be fired and prosecuted, period.
Fired and prosecuted. I agree with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Nancy, for your call. Yeah. Let's go to another caller here, Ken from San Francisco. Ken, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'd like to approach this from a different angle. I was talking with a retired police lieutenant a couple years ago, and at the time there was a scandal about an officer who had so abused a witness that he injured him severely. And the comment surprised me, but I think it has a lot of weight to any active duty officer, especially the young. And this retired police lieutenant said, how could he have so little regard for his career that he couldn't control himself on the job? Basically, he threw away his career, and so the interesting angle to me is there's a difference between taking a free donut, pardon the expression, that's illegal, and going way over the board to child molestation, trafficking, etc. It's a line no sane officer would cross if they want to keep their $90,000 plus salary. And these guys who are fired are never going to make that money again, likely. So from a very gut level of instructing officers, you know, here are some case studies of idiots who got caught. And there's a saying among police of a guy who has a habit of stepping in, shall we say, shite too often. They don't like him either. So these guys basically brought heat on the department, discredit, and now everyone's going to suffer the consequences of these officers. Have you ever addressed training from an angle of protect your career or else you're out in the streets and don't be an idiot on the job?
Thanks so much, Ken, for your call. Anyone here want to take that?
Well, I'll just say briefly, I think that could be a compelling angle for departments to take to try to head off this kind of behavior. I would worry that it would undermine the more important message, which is those principles of integrity that you want officers to try to uphold. So it shouldn't just be about losing your job. It should be about doing the right thing by your community. That said, sometimes it takes multiple things to motivate people to do what you want them to do, and it's okay to have complimentary messages like that.
Dan, did you want to add there?
There was an incident right when I first became city administrator back in 2008, and there were 12 officers who were found to have somewhere between misrepresented and lied on their search warrants. And we terminated all 12 of them. Now, they didn't all stay terminated because arbitration brought back 10 of them or 9 of them. I don't remember exactly. But we took the attitude that you do not lie. And their attitude was, well, you didn't train us not to lie. And we said that was really not part of your police training. That was just sort of part of being a human being, and you don't lie. You don't falsify information.
So this brings up the question. We do not have the labor at the table here. What would it take to really start to get at some of this this logjam when you're trying to do the right thing and discipline people, but then processes kind of turn back against you?
I don't know in this case what the process, where it stands. I don't know how many of these Oakland officers are going to be terminated. I don't know how many of them, where they stand in their disciplinary process. So I would presume that many of them will be terminated. It would be difficult for me to fathom that they won't be. But I don't know that.
Yeah, but I think Ken's point only makes sense is, in fact, if the threat can be carried through at the end, right?
Well, and I think the more important concern here is, of course, it's a concern when the union is able to push the person back onto the job. But the question becomes, is the relationship between the management and the union such that the management is afraid or reluctant to put the hammer down when the community thinks that they should, because they sense a futility in doing that? And that is something, I mean, if you're ever meeting with police chiefs, if you want to derail the conversation for 20 minutes, say the word union, and you will have a completely different conversation.
That's why I use the word labor. Anyway, let's go to Ben from Oakland. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey there. Hi. I was wondering if you guys had looked at, there's a website called justiceinpolicing.com, and one of the things that it does, that they talk about 15 policy proposals that would make a huge difference in terms of the way that our communities are policed. Among the things that you guys have already talked about is independent oversight, having a special or independent prosecutor, which is something that we don't have, having an inspector general or oversight commission, the public oversight commission, aside from demilitarizing the police force, having better data reporting, you know, making sure that there is a ban on bias. There is no formal ban on bias in the OPD or in any police department. There's not a policy against bias, which is ridiculous. So some of these things, some of these policy proposals would make a huge difference as far as pushing forward some real reform. I'm just surprised that we're letting, you know, I feel like we should fire the whole department almost and just start over, you know.
All right.
I don't understand.
I'm going to have you take your answer off the air because we want to get to a couple more calls before the end of the hour.
Okay.
So,
all right. Thank you.
Thank you. Jack Glazer?
Yes, you saw me shaking my head.
Yeah.
Most departments, if not all police departments, do have a ban on bias, and most cities and states have bans on bias. For some reason, the federal government doesn't have the appetite to pass a federal ban on bias in policing, but we'll see whether we get there. The problem is that it's not – It's pointless to just ban bias. These officers don't really have control over their bias to some extent, and what you really need are concrete, teeth laden policies and parameters that actually help them to not be biased and to carry out their jobs in a fair and equitable way.
Let's go next to Armand from San Francisco. Armand, brief comment here.
Yeah, no one's ever mentioned testing officers or potential officers, the FBI, the CIA, when they test people for biases and all kinds of things. They know more about the person than the person does. And rigorous testing for bias, which is really the place where I'm most anxious about, I've never heard anyone talk about weeding them out before they even get in.
Okay, we're going to
out after they have just really made at least one serious mistake.
Thanks, Armand, for your call. Jack, back to you on that one.
Yeah, sure. We do have a lot of methods for measuring bias, and particularly if we're talking about racial and ethnic bias, which is one of the big problems in policing these days. And those methods are fallible. And so actually people like me who study implicit bias and related concepts are reluctant to endorse the idea that that departments who are making hiring and promotion decisions should be using the kinds of measures that we have. Obviously, if somebody has a track record of belonging to a white supremacist group or if they are quite overtly biased and indicate that they cannot behave in an unbiased way, they're not fit for service. But people who score high on an implicit association test or something like that, because most people actually do score reasonably high on those, everybody gets, I think, deserves a fair shot based on their actual behavior. And that's, that's a challenge because these biases are quite pervasive. And if we're trying to ask police officers to treat people of color and white people equally and they're seeing them differently based on their unconscious biases, that's a tall order.
We had a comment in from Aaron in Oakland who wanted to know how much of this is another part of the recruiting is what pool are you recruiting from in terms of people's prior work experience? For example, veterans and people coming from the military. Not to lay this at the feet of veterans, but how much is coming into the police force? How much is of the recruits coming from people who are former military officers?
Just say this, historically, certainly in Oakland and in most departments, veterans, people in military service were always very desired to be police officers, and a number of them have been. The problem that I have seen more recently in my practice, that we have had people who have come from Afghanistan or from Iraq, and they have problems. And they have PTSD problems that may or may not get disclosed by the officer until after they've committed some atrocious act where they had a flashback and discharged their weapon. So I think this is a real issue that I think that, and any of these recruiting issues now where you're talking about bringing in people who have military experience, you need to know a lot more about them in terms of their military history and particularly their mental health history than before, because now that you have these veterans, I personally have seen that these PTSD symptoms rise, and they arise sometimes later than not, but they often rise when an officer has really discharged his weapon in ways that shouldn't have been, as if he was back in a war zone.
All right, so in the last couple of minutes of the program, we've talked about a lot of the root causes for why we find ourselves in this situation today with the Oakland PD and perhaps with a lot of other police departments across the country. And we've talked about policy as being very limited in its effect at really changing culture, which is what's going to really change policing. So in the last few minutes, how do we change culture? I want to start with you, Dan Lindheim.
Well, I mean, I think there have to be signals from everybody. During Mayor Dellum's time, he devoted speech after speech to the importance of implementing the negotiated settlement. I made inordinate efforts to make sure that the police department knew how important implementing the negotiated settlement
but
was.
But knowing what you know now, how would you change culture moving forward?
Like I said before, I think you have to involve the rank and file. You absolutely have to involve the rank and file, and you have to win the hearts and minds of the sergeants. And until you do that, you're really not going to be successful in bringing about change.
Jack Glazer?
I agree, and I would add that the elements of the culture that you prioritize have to saturate across the policy documentation and across the rhetoric within the department. So if integrity, egalitarianism, if those are the things that are important, they need to come across all the way. But I agree that it matters. The enculturation happens in the field. And I've had officers, not from Oakland, but I'm sure this has happened in Oakland, but I've had officers describe to me the deep effect of their first field training officer and how they could go from one FTO to another and have a very radically different experience, or even go from having their first shift be the graveyard shift, or as Oakland calls it, the dog watch, or versus a daytime shift where they are going to see people in a very different light, literally. So there's enculturation that happens in the training, and that's probably your best opportunity for changing the culture.
And you get the last word, John Burris.
Well, I think it's important, everything that's been said, but accountability, transparency are extraordinarily important. But I also think that you have to deal with the attitudes that gets transmitted to the officers from their sergeants and from their field training. At the end of the day, though, accountability for misconduct, accountability for poor attitudes and disrespect of people, that has to be transmitted, and it has to be, people have to be held accountable consistently. You have to have consistency in the application of your rules and your principles in order for it to stick.
Those values sound really good, but just are really hard to implement, isn't it?
Hey, I've been at it for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. So it sounds like the long game is culture change, but in the short run, accountability and consequences, it seems like. Well, I want to thank my guests for joining me this evening. We had in the studio here Jack Glazer, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, Dan Lindheim, former city administrator for the city of Oakland, and on the phone, John Burris, Oakland-based civil rights attorney. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton. Please join our guest host, Ann Harper, next Monday in conversation with the founder of Summer Search, Linda Mornell. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.